Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There is a lot going on campus. Football players convicted of rape, hard alcohol banned, sorority girls told to stay away from fraternities, students protesting steep tuition hikes, taking on racism with Black Lives Matter, and looking ahead to their own futures, hoping and dreaming. This hour on Point, from sex assault to the nation's future, we're talking with students, top college editors, about what they see now. Three top college newspaper editors are with us today. From Nashville, Tennessee, Tyler Bishop is here, editor-in-chief of the Vanderbilt Hustler. He's a senior studying political science and communications at Vanderbilt University. Last week, two ex-Vanderbilt football players were convicted in the rape of an unconscious fellow student. Two more await separate trials. Tyler Bishop, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me today.
You bet. From Charlottesville, Virginia, Julia Horowitz joins us, editor-in-chief of the Cavalier Daily, the student newspaper at the University of Virginia, where now discredited allegations of a fraternity gang rape published in Rolling Stone were supposed to have taken place. But a lot of soul-searching there. Julia is a junior studying political and social thought. Julia Horowitz, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Catherine McKay joins us, editor-in-chief of The Dartmouth. Last week, Dartmouth president Phil Hanlon announced some major changes on campus, including a ban on hard alcohol and Greek life pledging. She's a junior studying English and creative writing. Katie McKay, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Okay, you've each got stories to tell, and I want to hear those and then get beyond them as well. But take us in, Tyler. I mean, this story that came off your campus was the first of this kind of flood of headlines that got our attention. Brandon Vandenberg, Corey Beatty, two former football players there, found guilty on lots of counts of aggravated rape and more. How is that going down on campus, Tyler? Are there more trials to come? Is this seen as an outlier? Or is Vanderbilt saying, hey, we've got a front and center problem here?
Well, I think Vanderbilt, like a lot of other schools, are taking this issue head on. It's definitely something that's been going on for years and years. And while, you know, it's awful that this case happened, what it's done is kind of put this conversation back at the forefront of students' minds again. When the case first started breaking headlines 19 months ago, when these football players were dismissed and details started rolling out, you know, whispers about this issue started rolling up, and then, mm-hmm. you know, we've seen the conversation about rape and sexual assault on campus just continually increase. And I think what it's done is kind of motivate activist students to take the initiative themselves and say, this has to be something that we confront as a student body. But I think the other big thing is that, you know, such heinous details coming out, it's just really has rocked a lot of students on campus, and it's just... It's been crazy to see these details unfold in a dorm where my peers live.
Liv, I want to ask you about that. Here's a little tape of Corey Beatty, who, along with Brandon Vandenberg, ex-Vanderbilt football players, they found guilty. Here's Beatty on the stand during the trial.
Can you explain your actions?
I'm just sorry. I never intended on hurting anyone. I was extremely intoxicated.
Okay. But help us understand, Tyler. I mean, you say heinous details, and it's true. I mean, people wouldn't have even have known, but they looked at the closed-circuit TV, right, and they saw this girl being dragged around, dragged into a room, half-naked and all the rest, and then cell phone footage from the trial itself. To the extent you can on the air, remind us of what was going on here, and more importantly, help us try to understand how this could be part of just a, hey, party night at school.
Absolutely, and... What's scary about this case is that, you know, none of this would have ever come to light if it hadn't been for an unrelated surveillance review for vandalism in Gillette. So, I mean, the only reason he's on the stand apologizing is because this event came under scrutiny. So it really makes you think what's going
on. What else is going on? They looked back on the closed-circuit TV images and they saw, you know, players carrying this unconscious woman into an elevator and down a hallway and taking compromising pictures of her, dragging her into a room. In that room, there was a lot of really outrageous stuff that went on. Water bottles and all the rest, deeply sort of grossly involved. Where does this come from?
You know, it's scary. And but I think what we've got to remember, though, is most cases of campus sexual assault probably don't look as heinous as this. They're more characterized by gray areas and he said, she said controversies. And so while this has really brought, you know, this issue back under the spotlight, what's really going on, I think, on college campuses is this culture of drug and alcohol abuse, and then students not really knowing, you know, what really, frankly, what they're doing when they engage in these activities, and then getting to the point where, you know, it really becomes an issue of somebody's been assaulted, something's gone wrong here, and then, you know, a lot of regret, and it's becoming a problem.
I mean, alcohol lowers inhibitions, but that doesn't mean that you have to end up in a scene like this with everything being,
absolutely,
you know, on cell phone, really, really gross stuff going on, this poor girl, you know, unconscious, and all the rest. Julie Horowitz, on your campus, the big spotlight came on with the Rolling Stone piece that described this graphic gang rape in the UVA fraternity, alleged. Of course, it came back later that there were all kinds of problems with the reporting. But here's some tape of your president there at UVA, Virginia Teresa Sullivan. This is back in December, before the story was discredited, saying UVA would lead in the face of the controversy.
That behavior that was depicted there is not something we will accept as normal. And the actions described by seven men in the story have betrayed us. We have a problem, and we're going to get after it.
Seven men and alleged graphic gang rape in a fraternity. Julia Horowitz, how far back has that story been walked by Rolling Stone? What are there any facts to look at here at this point?
Absolutely. I think that what's important to remember with that story is that for about 2 weeks on campus, it still took hold. You know, there was a long period of soul searching where we were looking at instituting real policy reforms. And so concern about sexual assault on campus, despite the specific details of that story, was rooted in some sort of reality. So I think looking back at the story now, while there's a lot of resentment on campus just because the specific details thrust us into the spotlight, you know, slightly unceremoniously, I think that it is still important that we're reforming our fraternal organization agreements. You know, we're looking at how we can make campus a safer space, because I don't know if anyone on a college campus today would argue that fraternity parties or college parties in general are exceptionally safe spaces for women.
How do you reform fraternal organizations or party rules or you name it to prevent this kind of thing if it's out there? What steps are being taken, Julia?
So on January 16th, President Teresa Sullivan released information that they had been working with fraternity presidents and sexual assault advocacy groups to develop a new agreement for these fraternities. So there have been a few things that have been instituted. There's now high requirements of sober brothers. There has to be food, water at these parties. All parties are operating on a closed guest list, which was not the case before. Someone has to have a key to all the bedrooms, and there's actually going to be hired security outside every party that's been registered, as well as a police station that's been set up on the corner, which is kind of the hub of student life off grounds.
We'll look more at that. And then there's Dartmouth, where the president has come out just in the last week to announce an outright ban on hard alcohol on campus. Gave a speech just last Thursday, Dartmouth College President Philip Hanlon.
High-risk drinking is far too prevalent on our campus, and that in the vast majority of alcohol-induced medical transports, it's hard alcohol rather than beer or wine that lands students on a hospital gurney. Dartmouth will take the lead among colleges in banning hard alcohol on our campus.
Katie McKay at Dartmouth, at The Dartmouth, the newspaper there. How's that going down?
Yeah, so this hard alcohol ban was announced on Thursday. It will not be taking effect until the first day of spring term, so that'll be in March. I think students have mixed reactions, though there's been general support from both faculty and Greek alums and Greek House advisors. Overall, in our reporting, we looked at Colby, we looked at Bowdoin, schools that have similar bans, and a lot of students raised some concerns about sort of enforcement, implementation, and I think right now it's too soon to tell how effective it will be, given that it hasn't even taken effect, but it is hopeful, and there does seem to be general support from a lot of adults in the community. I think students still have some serious questions about implementation. And the ban is one part of this policy, but there's also going to be a requirement for third-party bartenders, third-party bouncers at a lot of events. It's unclear what size events will require these, but that will be another aspect of this plan going forward. They will also increase the rounds that undergraduate advisors, which are like the RAs at Dartmouth, will be doing.
Yep.
As well as hiring more safety and security personnel.
Katie, what appears to have really driven this? Was it sexual assault problems? Was it hazing problems? Something else?
Well, Dartmouth has come under sort of intense media scrutiny in the past few years. I think one of the catalyzing events was the op-ed in our newspaper that then became a Rolling Stone expose written by Andrew Loess, who was a member of the class of 2012. He wrote about his experiences with fraternity hazing, and that really increased the media spotlight on Dartmouth. And since then, we had protests 2 years ago, my freshman year, at our Dimensions show, which is our weekend for accepted students. Mm-hmm. Then we also had a protest this past spring. A group of students staged a sit-in in the president's office, and they were sort of raising issues of both sexual assault, the general culture at Dartmouth, as well as inclusivity, issues of racism, classism, sexism, etc. So I think it's been a lot of issues that have been raised, and it's sort of...
Katie, hold the thought. We'll come back to it. It's a long list. It's a rich list. It's not all that's going on college campuses, and we want to fully acknowledge that. But these headlines have been huge lately and really turned people's heads. Katie McKay at Dartmouth, Julia Horowitz at the University of Virginia, Tyler Bishop at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. Please stand by. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking with three young college newspaper editors this hour about all the headlines we're seeing off campuses lately. Sexual assault, alcohol bans, tuition hikes, Greek life troubles, and I hope a little bit of their dreams. It's not all woe out there. Tyler Bishop is with us, editor-in-chief at the Vanderbilt Hustler, student newspaper at Vanderbilt University, joins us from Nashville. Julia Horowitz with us from Charlottesville, Virginia, editor-in-chief at the Cavalier Daily, the paper there. Katie Catherine McKay is with us from Dartmouth, editor-in-chief of the Dartmouth. It's all out there in the popular culture, Sundance Film Festival going on, The Hunting Ground, big documentary there, big reception there. It's about rape culture on college campuses. Here's a little bit from the trailer, two students talking about their experience.
The first few weeks, I made some of my best friends, but two of us were sexually assaulted before classes had even started.
I went to the dean of students' office. And she said, I just want to make sure that you don't talk to anyone about this.
College as the hunting ground in the documentary of the same name. Women at UVA, sororities, Julia Horowitz's school were banned from attending bid night parties at fraternity houses this last weekend. Some of those young college women were outraged by the national sorority orders coming down here. Sarah Surface.
This is not an issue of we're angry because we can't go out and drink and party. It's an issue over whether or not we had the choice.
The students are right here with us. What's your question? Josh in Yukon, Oklahoma. Josh, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I think the conversation that you guys are having about starting this at colleges is a little premature. I think really it needs to start at the high schools. I have an 18-year-old stepdaughter that's about to go to college, and I understand that your guests there are talking about having a conversation on colleges, but why not start the conversation at high schools where some of these students are going out in the middle of the field and drinking and the sexual assaults are going on here? I'll take my comments off here.
Josh, I appreciate your call. Tyler, let me come to you. I don't know how it felt to you. I mean, you know, we don't want to just sit around tut-tutting young people these days. You could do that in any year, in any decade, any time. But the headlines are arresting. Josh calls from Oklahoma and says, you know what, it starts in high school. I don't know, did you feel that you stepped into some wild bubble when you got to college, when you got to Vanderbilt, Tyler, where suddenly you were in some whole new cultural arena where crazy stuff was happening? Or is there a glide path here?
Yeah, I think that's something I can speak to personally, actually. I went to high school in a relatively tame town. I really didn't know what to expect with regard to party culture at a school like Vanderbilt. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you really get here and your access to alcohol and drugs is just, it's really not difficult to get your hands on something if you want it. So I think I couldn't agree more. I think that students really need to be educated more about these kinds of things if they are going to go to a big school.
Julia, do you see students stepping into a whole new world when they hit college these days? Or what about our caller Josh saying, oh, this is going on in high school. There's a deeper beginning to this.
I would absolutely agree with him. Just based on conversations that I've had with friends and with survivors, I know people who have been impacted by sexual assault long before they ever stepped on UVA's campus. That being said, I think that there is a dearth of information that is reaching students right when they first get there. You know, there's certain things that I know as a junior and that I knew as a sophomore, but that I didn't know as a freshman. And those first 3 weeks when you step onto a college campus are actually known as the red zone. That's when the risk of sexual assault is the highest. And so I think that getting information to that most vulnerable group is something that's very important. So I feel safe now. But if I had known how risky that period was when I first got to UVA, I don't know if I would have felt as comfortable.
Can you explain what just happened at UVA with the sororities there? They were banned from attending bid night. Remind us what that is and who issued this ban and why?
So bid night happens every single year to celebrate the end of boys' recruitment. Girls' recruitment happens a little bit earlier.
Into Greek life, into fraternities we're talking about here, I guess, right?
Correct, yes, okay. Into fraternities. Mm-hmm. And so once the boys hand out their bids, they have big parties that night. It's typically open parties. You can go from house to house, and it's just a general night of revelry. Mm-hmm. What happened was about a week or so before this event, national sorority presidents all got together, wrote a letter, and sent it to individual chapters at UVA saying, you know, we strongly encourage you to plan alternate sisterhood events.
National sorority heads, like the national heads of these sororities, singled out your school and sororities there?
They did, and that was a lot of the problem. You know,
why did they do that?
Why are we being singled out?
Well, what did they say? The Rolling Stone article was discredited, so what's going on?
They did not provide actual rationale for why UVA. You know, they said that they're focused on member safety, that girls have never been allowed to participate in boys' recruitment, and so they're just enforcing this rule. But it was never particularly clear why they decided to come down so hard on UVA specifically. You know, was it because we were already in national headlines and they didn't want to exacerbate that? Maybe. But that was never really made clear, and I think that was a lot of the frustration.
Katie McKay at Dartmouth, another part of what came out last week was a reining in of the way fraternities work in particular. And the pledge period specifically, what's the change there, Katie?
Yeah, so in the Moving Dartmouth Forward proposal that was announced in Phil Hanlon's speech on Thursday, they talked about pledge terms, but that reform actually came out of a lot of student initiatives. In this past fall term, Greek houses on campus decided unanimously to eliminate their pledge term, which would be
meaning sort of that time when the hazing sort of traditionally goes on, when you're still a junior fraternity member, not full-fledged yet.
Yes. Pledge term generally is a sort of formal official period where the new members of the house are not fully members yet, and so they often are subjected to different tasks. That's not unique to Dartmouth, but ban on pledge term. I guess it's not a ban because students chose to eliminate.
So what is the change
term?
That you're, no one's a pledge anymore? You're either in or out?
Yes, people are full members as soon as they join these Greek houses. So that's meant to sort of get rid of this stratification within the house and to increase inclusivity. And
it seems more aimed at hazing. More aimed at hazing than at the sexual assault problem.
Yes, that's definitely more aimed at hazing, although there were sexual assault reforms in the Moving Dartmouth Forward proposal, but sort of what we've been receiving from the administration is this idea that we actually already have a zero tolerance policy. We enacted that in this between the spring and summer interim. It took effect for our summer term and then has been in effect ever since. So a lot of what we got in the Moving Dartmouth Forward proposal was programming. They're going to create a safety app. They're going to create an online consent manual. There's a support group that's in partnership with WISE, which is an organization in the Upper Valley. And so it's a lot of sort of additional things on top of this zero tolerance policy. And
you mentioned consent right there, and I wanted to ask you about that, because in California they've got this already. Now the governor of New York is looking at legislation that would require affirmative consent around sexual activity. Is that a topic of conversation at Dartmouth? When you say talk about online consent, what do you mean there?
So this consent manual hasn't been released yet, but it will likely be sort of hypothetical scenarios in which consent is or is not given to help students get a better understanding of what consent really means in practice on
college
campuses.
So you're in a kind of a sexual circumstance, and do you go forward or not? And what should you look for so that you know you're not assaulting someone? You wouldn't think you need a handbook for that, but maybe so.
Right. Well, a lot of conversations around sexual violence on college campuses sort of have this premise that it is hard to tell. Tyler said this earlier. There are students who are drinking. Both parties often are drinking, and it is apparently hard to tell what's going on. So this consent manual is sort of aimed at that idea and sort of trying to cut to the core of what consent is and make it as clear as possible for students. And I think the standard at Dartmouth is that consent should be clear and it should not be ambiguous. So they're trying to create a manual to reflect policy that's also clear and not ambiguous.
Let's go to Miami, Florida, if I may. Jesus is calling. Jesus, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here with you. My question is about the sexual consent, about the rape cases that have been going on around the country, and about whether or not these cases are being abused, because we have now women coming out after a year and 10 years saying that they were raped. And while, yes, there is some cases like I believe Julia was saying, that some women are told not to go out and say what it is that happened, those cases are apparent. But
Jesus, let me ask you, let's say somebody felt assaulted or raped. Is she wrong to come forward a year later if she didn't feel comfortable coming forward immediately? Is there something wrong with that?
It's not that there's nothing wrong with that. Absolutely not. But I just feel like they should come out immediately. And if it is true that it happened, let that guy rot in jail for what he did. But what I'm seeing a lot lately in the news is that women are coming out saying that they were raped, and the guys are coming out and saying that it didn't happen, and that during the whole time that this supposedly occurred, they were drunk. So, and when people are drunk, they don't know what they're doing. So I just feel that there's something that's missing from there, and I think it's being abused from the people who are actually raped and the people who are not.
Hey, Jesus, I appreciate your call. Julie, let me bring that to you. On your campus these days, there's been so much talk about, do women feel safe and empowered to come forward and say what's happened? And then in many of these cases, you've got sometimes attorneys standing up for the guys saying, you know, this is a misrepresentation of what happened. On your campus, do you have the sense, Julia, that women feel comfortable coming forward immediately and saying, hey, here's what happened?
I think that it's becoming readily apparent that that is not always the case. That could be from a number of factors, be that a lack of administrative support, which they're admittedly trying to address, but also just the nature of trauma, where, you know, there's some details that become apparent, you know, maybe months, years, even after an assault. And so to say that, you know, the night of these women who have been assaulted need to go immediately to the hospital, need to go immediately to the police, to the administration, you know, that's ideal, but it's also a little bit unrealistic when you're thinking about the very nature of this traumatic event.
Hey, Tyler, you know, in the case of the two football players who have been convicted, and they could go to prison, to Jesus' point, they could go for decades here, potentially. The main defense seemed to be, certainly in Beatty's case, I was so drunk, I didn't know what was going on. I'm sorry, but I was drunk. How far does that excuse fly at Vanderbilt, Tyler? Not
that
very far in this court.
No, absolutely not. That excuse is not accepted by Vanderbilt students. It's not accepted by the Vanderbilt administration, and it really isn't accepted by society. I think that really infuriated a lot of people when they heard that case being made in court. You know, you can't excuse something so heinous, you know, based on, you know, your decision to abuse drugs and or alcohol. So I think when you talk about these issues, you really have to get back to that idea of consent and what you're doing to make sure that you are prepared to go into situations where you, if you're going to drink, do it responsibly. If you're going to have sex, do it responsibly. And what I think we're seeing is more an active effort to make sure that that is the case among students.
What do you think about the idea of affirmative consent? Like both partners have to basically be saying yes explicitly before it's a go-ahead on sex.
I think it's a good idea, but I think it also goes back to, you know, those two people most of the time are going to be the only two people in the room, so it's really hard to, after the fact, figure out was affirmative consent given. And so I think that's a big aspect of the conversation and deciding policymaking and lawmaking based on that.
You might have to pull the cell phone out to record that piece of things. Lorraine in Plattsburgh, New York. Lorraine, you're on the air. Thank you.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you for having this program. It's very relevant. I taught at SUNY Plattsburgh about this over 20 years ago in 1993.
Taught about what, Lorraine? Sexual assault? Or
sexual assault. Okay. And when no means no.
Yeah.
I did it with another male counselor for this program that I was in, and we discussed this topic 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And then my daughter became a victim of sexual assault in 2009, and she reported it, and it... The reason, and this is why I'm very mad.
Was it one of these one-on-one, he said, she said?
No, it was five guys, a basketball team from a different school than she was attending. She told the dean, rather her advisor, about this before she told us,
yeah,
4 days later.
Yeah.
And we took her to the police, and the police victim's advocate at the place said, maybe you might not want to take this all away because a girl previous year had been assaulted by a basketball player. And the whole thing is the victim, and what happened here, the victim became victimized again.
So how did it turn out, and what did you learn from it, Lorraine?
Well, what happened is my daughter went through the grand jury. It was a very trying affair.
Yeah.
What I learned about it, and what my daughter has learned, she will defend herself, but she was intoxicated at the time.
Yeah.
And the DA, they couldn't prove it because of... one of the basketball players reported it to the coach at the school, what had happened. And there's a group called Security on Campus. I don't know if you're aware of this group, but they helped us with this case. They went and contacted this school, which I don't want to use their
but
name.
But were there convictions or not, Lorraine?
No, there wasn't a conviction because the victim wasn't considered credible because there were all these other... She didn't know anybody at this party, and all of these people had the same story. Even though one guy was holding the door saying, me next, into a bathroom door.
What do you take away from this, Lorraine? You taught about this 20 years ago, and then it comes around and hits your daughter. What do you take away?
What I have to say is men, what we need to have is men need to know, and this is what came from my daughter's, thank God there was a sexual assault counselor that helped her through this.
Yeah.
And at that, we need to have sexual assault counseling for the victims and advocates like they have in New York State. But they also, one of the things is that we have to do is to train the young men that, and this is where I was doing, trying to do in 1993, the men have to be trained when a woman says no, or if it's not sure, or if there's a group mentality. I don't know. I think it's a group mentality. These
yep.
guys get together and they think they can take advantage of girls.
Lorraine, we're up against the clock here, but no means no again. 1993 is a long time ago, and still, maybe it hasn't sunk in. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. A special thank you, Audible.com would like to offer you a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial membership. Audible has over 150,000 titles, fiction, nonfiction, bestsellers, every category imaginable. They also have tons of exclusive content you can't get anywhere else. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, choose a free book and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint. Get started today.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with three young college newspaper editors about all the headlines we're seeing off campuses lately. Sexual assault, alcohol bans, tuition hikes, Greek life issues. And there has been action at all of these schools on a lot of different fronts. You've probably seen the headlines. It's hardly been quiet. Lots of response to our conversation, Tyler, Julia, Katie. Heather says, why are we telling girls to stay away from fraternities? Why aren't we discussing sexual assault and saying merely rape is rape? Well, we've been saying that for a while, but still, problems. Ian writes to us, let me just say, as a male who has been in all forms of intoxication, never was there one moment ever, Ian writes to us, that I did not know right from wrong. I did make bad decisions, but there was never a moment that I didn't know it was a bad decision. He doesn't want to see this blanket of, oh, I was drunk, so I had no idea, thrown over things. And here's another listener on Facebook writes, please address the role of hookup culture in sex and alcohol-related violence about the lack of dating culture. We'll look at that as well. Jennifer in Spokane, Washington, you are on with our three top student editors.
Hi, Tom. I'm a university professor here in Spokane, and I'm interested. I think the conversation has been focusing a lot around the role of the women. Women should not go to fraternities. They should not drink so much. They should report or they shouldn't report. And I'd really like to think about maybe education in a broader sense for men and women, because think about the role it might play to have bystander education. Think about,
you mean like to intervene if you see something going on that's not right?
Exactly. We have that here at my university and a number in the area where, you know, if you see someone who's too drunk to stand up, what should you do for them? Or how to defuse a situation, or how to, you know, how to take care of your peers, essentially. And I wonder if any one of your speakers has been trained like that or has training like that at their university.
Julia, can you speak to that? And what about just the general dynamic of adults stepping in to put up guidelines and so on? Do students want that? Maybe they feel like they need it, or maybe they feel like you just don't get it.
I'm actually so glad you brought that up. That's actually been a lot of the focus of the conversation here at UVA.
Mm-hmm.
In January, we had Green Dot come in, which is a campus safety program, to do a huge bystander training program. They had trained the first class of, I think, about 100 people there, and they're now going to be going out into the community and leading these educational programs themselves. And even before everything happened with Rolling Stone, there was a Who's Got Your Back campaign on grounds where people were really pushing for bystander intervention. You know, bouncers at bars on the corner were wearing T-shirts to show that, you know, they didn't tolerate this kind of behavior. And people were talking about the need for greater bystander intervention training. So that actually has been the focus of a lot of the dialogue here at UVA.
Go a little deeper with this. We've also got this person on Facebook here saying, talk about hookup culture in the absence of dating culture. I don't know, Julia, do you see something having come unmoored here? Is there too much freedom and license, and this all sort of begins to flow together? Or does that not make sense to you? How do you respond?
I would hesitate to blame any sort of cultural hookup norm for the increased attention that sexual assault on college campuses have gotten. You know, I don't get the impression that this is a particularly new problem, just that it's an increasingly visible one.
Mm-hmm.
I think that college hookup culture is definitely unique in that there's definitely a decrease in, you know, serious dating, but that doesn't mean it's extinct entirely.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I think that the correlation between the two is murky.
Tyler, what do you think about that question from our listener?
Well, I think I couldn't agree more that bystander intervention has to be a strong part of the conversation, and I think it has been at Vanderbilt for years now. Green Dot is also the program utilized by Vanderbilt, and I think students are actually embracing this idea pretty wholeheartedly. The IFC fraternity men, themselves agreed recently to have all new members, all pledges trained in this program to go through a 6-hour program.
And again, it's if you see something that looks exploitive or wrong going on, that you what? Say something, intervene, call somebody in, intervene yourself.
Right. Essentially do whatever you can to interrupt a situation that's going downhill. It's called a red dot, essentially.
Yeah.
And yeah, whether that be spill a drink, whether it be to interrupt the mood, whether it be to confront it explicitly,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's what you've got to do to make a difference. And I think going through that education really will have a big difference. And I'm actually an advocate for every college student on every campus to go through this training. I think it's something that really could have a difference. So I couldn't agree more.
Katie, where do you think the lack of self-restraint is coming from here when things move into assault? I mean, of course, it's always happened in history, but you always want to be minimizing it. You know, why do we have to have intervention here? What's happened to the brakes?
Well, I think that bystander intervention and the question of the lack of self-restraint are sort of two different questions.
Okay.
I think Tyler noted earlier that a lot of these situations actually involve two people in a room behind closed doors.
Yeah.
Well, and we do have a comprehensive bystander intervention program, the Dartmouth Bystander Initiative, and it's this also a 6-hour training, and they also have 1-hour condensed versions. And actually, every new member at a Greek house has to undergo this training. But the question of self-restraint sort of gets at this idea that regardless of how frequently or for how long we hold these bystander trainings, it's still going to be two people behind a closed door, and intervention can only go so far. So the question of self-restraint really gets at sort of whether or not perpetrators are always aware of what they're doing and what the dynamic really is when the people who could intervene aren't there. And I think that a lot of research, particularly David Lisak, he's probably the leading researcher in the mm-hmm. field, does show that many perpetrators are aware of their actions. And a lot of research also indicates that correcting these false perceptions of social norms really helps to decrease the incidence of sexual assault.
Talk about it. Put it out there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing that DBI, the Dartmouth Bystander Initiative, sort of aims to achieve, is correct these social norms that may drive perpetrator behavior.
Speaking of closed doors, here Jan has a question online. She says, I'm interested to know how Dartmouth monitors the ban on hard liquor. Regular room checks, is her question? Katie?
Dartmouth,
how's it going to work? They're going to come around and look in everybody's closet and you know, under your socks?
I mean, that is the question on campus nowadays. How will this be enforced? And as of right now, it seems unclear. There hasn't been sort of a concrete announcement or any sort of fully parsed out plan laid out for us about how this will look going forward. I think that the dean of the college is going to be working with other members of the college community to create a more specific plan. But as of right now, sort of, we really only know that they're probably going to mandate third party bartenders, bouncers. They're also going to increase the safety and security staff. And they're going to increase the rounds that our undergraduate advisors have to do. Beyond that, it's unclear how this will be enforced. And that's sort of why it's too soon to talk about this ban at Dartmouth,
mm-hmm.
because while it is sort of a groundbreaking idea in some ways, because we are the first school in a lot of our peers to do this,
So,
don't really know what it'll look like.
Hot off the presses, Jan. We're going to have to wait and see what the details are. Rachel in Nashville. Rachel, thank you for calling from Tennessee.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Nice to talk to you today.
Great to have you. What's your experience?
Well, I agree that sexual assault for undergraduates is a huge problem, but it is a general culture at universities. I've been at a couple of large, well-respected state universities now, both as a graduate student and as a junior faculty member.
Okay.
When I was working on my PhD, two of my colleagues had to drop out of their program because they were assaulted by their advisors. When I was an assistant professor, there was another faculty member there who assaulted several of the junior female faculty.
And do you mean literally assaulted, Rachel, not just came on to, which is his own ethical issue in that case? But
yes, I mean, he trapped one of my peers in her office and physically assaulted her.
Wow. What do you take from that? We're trying to tell students to, you know, stay on the straight and narrow here, and you're talking about senior faculty.
Yes, and so when students say, I reported this and no one listened to me, I believe them. because there's a culture at universities that needs to be addressed, and it extends beyond just undergraduates. There's a reason that some administrators have a hard time hearing that. They know what's happening behind closed faculty doors. And there are also some very wonderful professors who are trying to overcome this, but it is a battle among within the institution, not just among the 20-year-olds on campus.
Rachel, that gets very interesting. I don't know, Julia, this may be on your pay grade, but do you sense that there's some hesitance to dive into this because there's more complicity than immediately meets the eye?
That's actually not something I've ever heard before, and absolutely something I would maybe want the Cavalier Daily or student paper to start looking into, because that's a whole new layer of nuance that we haven't really even thought about.
Editor smells a story. Watch this space. Rachel, thank you for your call. Joe in Hartford, Connecticut. Joe, you're on.
Hi, John.
Hi.
How are you today?
Well, okay. Learning. What do you know?
Well, I am a graduate of a small Ivy school. My wife attended the same school, my late wife. We, for years, stood opposed to the fraternity system, felt that fraternity members were protected from all sorts of illegal behavior, not just sexual assaults. And all of our complaints fell on deaf ears for 30 years. Now, 2 years ago at our alma mater, a student was nearly beaten to death, a male student. And for the best that we can figure out as alum, the best story we can get, the rumor among the inside people on campus, is that this was a case of fraternity-on-fraternity violence. And it was hushed up by the school. It was written off as someone from the neighborhood must have come on campus and beaten up one of our students.
So here's another angle, Joe, but is there some common underlying issue here that you would relate to the sexual assault theme that seems to have taken over our conversation? What is it?
As a guidance counselor, I will say this. The wealthy protect their children from the consequences of their actions, big and small. And when the wealthy children get to colleges and universities, they believe they should be protected even from sexual assault. The laws don't apply
from sexual assault charges.
Well, the laws don't apply to them, and the colleges protect them from the laws of the city where the college is located, the laws of the state. They are a law unto themselves, and that's what's got to be addressed. That's what's got to be stopped.
Let me take that to my young guests, if I may, Joe, and I appreciate your call. Tyler Bishop, Vanderbilt, plenty of well-heeled students attending there. In your observation, is this part of the problem? They're backed up by influential families who don't want them to be in trouble.
You know, there's certainly a sense of entitlement among a lot of students. But I think what I'd also say is that I think what a place like Vanderbilt and Dartmouth and UVA, what they do, they bring together students from a lot of different backgrounds who are forced really to interact a little bit. And I think that while it's not a fix to the problem, while there certainly is a sense of entitlement that may contribute to this holier-than-now view where you can't be convicted of anything like sexual assault or, the other number of issues that go on, I think that kind of encouraging conversations and interactions among differing groups is really the cultural fix there, and I think that's something we're starting to see a little bit more.
Hey, Tyler, you know, I feel bad to bring in such smart young newspaper editors and only talk about this issue, because I know and you know there's a lot more going on campuses. As important
Definitely.
As this is and as difficult as it is, what else has been at the top of your sort of editor's list lately, Tyler? What are the big issues are you paying attention to as editor of the Vanderbilt Hustler?
You know, it's actually tangentially related to what I just said. I think race and diversity on the Vanderbilt campus and kind of trying to understand what it really, really means to be inclusive here at Vanderbilt is something that I think a lot of students, administrators, faculty are really trying to hone in on, because we see, especially in the wake of Ferguson and those protests, the Black Lives Matter movement, there are legitimately students who do not feel safe, who do not feel welcome
on 2015,
campus.
You'd think you'd be beyond
in
that
2015.
By now.
Absolutely. You really would. But you hear from these students these personal anecdotes of situations in which they just don't feel comfortable on campus, and it's really heartbreaking. So really kind of honing in on how to address that in a more meaningful way is
Black
something
Lives
that we've
Matter.
Been paying a lot of yep. attention to.
And yeah. diversity. Julia, our time is short, but what's at the top of your story list beyond the one we've been honing in on?
Something I think that the UVA community is going to need to come back to at some point is the issue of providing financial aid so that we can ensure socioeconomic diversity mm-hmm. here at UVA's campus. Last year, they stopped supplying grant-only aid packages. So every aid package now that comes from Access UVA includes some kind of loan. And there was some pushback to that because they were saying that that makes UVA inaccessible to some students.
Yep.
That should never be the case. So that's a story that's kind of taken the back burner, but I could see us returning to very soon.
Another kind of diversity there related. And Katie McKay, how about you? Look on down your list of issues. What's got your eye as a young, hot editor at Dartmouth?
Yeah, I would like to reiterate the themes of inclusivity, both racially as well as socioeconomic status. I think Black Lives Matter has also had an impact at Dartmouth, and we face many similar issues as Vanderbilt. I also think that financial aid are important. If I'm talking about Dartmouth specifically, another interesting component of this idea of inclusivity and of racial equality on college campuses is that we struggle with minority faculty retention, and that's another one of the initiatives that's coming out of the Moving Dartmouth Forward plan is to increase the recruitment of minority faculty members and also make it more of the type of place where minority faculty members are likely to stay as well. So I would love to see sort of an investigative piece into the minority faculty experience at Dartmouth.
Watch the front page there at the Dartmouth. You know, you three are each so great. This has been a good conversation. I'd love to have you all three back and take it on the road a little bit. Look beyond sexual assault and a couple of headlines and dig in. Let's find a time to do that. Catherine, Katie, McKay at the Dartmouth in Hanover, New Hampshire. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us today, Katie.
Thank you.
Julia Horowitz at the Cavalier Daily, University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Julia, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And Tyler Bishop, editor-in-chief of the Vanderbilt Hustler, no less, at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. Tyler, thanks for taking the time today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.